and welcome to the Veterans Ascend Weekly Podcast. Today, we are honored to speak with Bruce Florsheim. Bruce is a retired lieutenant colonel, having served over 25 years in the United States Army. He now co-manages two small businesses that he and his partners started to provide engineering services and product development for wearable robotics technologies. Bruce is a licensed professional engineer with extensive experience in engineering design and analysis, program management, quality assurance, risk management, and a development of strategic plans for products and programs. He's also an associate professor, researcher, and author, published in multiple journals on topics ranging from technical engineer analysis of structures to engineering education to strategy for the U.S. Army force allocation in the future. One of Bruce's co-owned companies is Fit Scientific, named number 27 on the Inc. 5000 list and number one on the list of veteran-owned companies. We are privileged to hear about Bruce's service in the Army, his transition and journey that led him to wearable robotics, co-managing two successful companies, and the rise of Fit Scientific to be number one on the list of veteran-owned businesses. Bruce, thank you so much for your time today. I'm just super excited. Congratulations on the success of Fit Scientific. We're going to hear more about that. But first, tell us about your service in the Army, your transition. What was your biggest challenge?
Thank you, Robin, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your audience today. So my service in the Army, just briefly, as you mentioned, 25 years, but it was a fairly non-traditional path. I had, within that 25 years, about 8 years as a combat engineer, served and commanded in Bosnia with I-4 for a year, and shortly thereafter was offered the opportunity to go back and get a graduate degree and then teach at West Point. And so through the latter part of my career, there was a combination of teaching at West Point as an associate professor, and then also doing program management work and helping to get program set up over in Iraq in 2004. And it was really kind of through that time that, as I was looking back on things, I found that I had done program management, I had run a research center, I had been a combat engineer. In the case of the research center, I had to get my own funding and I had to hire my own people to, you know, support me in that center, and kind of started getting a little bit of the bug there for a business, because I realized that I kind of had that entrepreneurial spirit. It was just kind of being used in a different fashion. So that was my time in the Army. And while I was there, I ended up meeting Joe Hitt, who's now my business partner and co-founder for our two main companies. We spent about, I met him for the first time in 1999. And over the course of the next 15 years, we served multiple tours together. We had kids that were in daycare together and went to school together. We even shared a wall with a townhouse. His family lived on one side, I lived on the other. So, you know, we really got a chance to get to know each other. And that ultimately, over the course of the 15 years, proved to be very, very important, because there was a lot of inherent trust. We knew each other so well. Mm-hmm. And in business, I found that that is the most important thing to be able to have with your business partner. I've met many others who have apocryphal stories about businesses that they had started up and that had run off the rails because problems with, you know, with the partners. Transition, that was interesting, because it was not just me who had to transition. At that time, my wife had spent 20 years married to me. And at the time I had met her, she was still she was in college, and she was still a dependent for her parents, who were career Air Force. So she had grown up in and around the military all of her life. That's all she knew. And I had, at that point, three kids. One was in college, one was in high school, and one was in middle school. All they had ever known was the military. And so it really was truly a family transition. And it was difficult for everybody, I think, having spent so much time around the wonderful community that is a military community. You just, again, it's one of those things where military people, because we move around so much, you very quickly get to know people during kind of the summer move cycle where everybody's coming in or going out. People aren't shy. You meet somebody and there's immediately a bond there. And my kids, And my wife found the same thing. So when we were doing the transition, it's like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen going forward? We're going to be a little unmoored here. We're going to be living out in another community, and one that does not look like, you know, this military community we've been living in. One of the things that was really, really helpful, and I have counseled people who are transitioning themselves over the last 6 years since I got out, people have asked for some advice. And one of the things I say that is most important is I said, you know, before you start your new job, whatever that is, if you're going to start a new job or new career, you and especially your spouse, if you're married, should take some time to take a couple of weeks off. Maybe it's after your retirement ceremony, maybe while, you know, you're on terminal leave, and go away someplace. In the case of my wife and myself, we took a 2-week cruise to the Mediterranean and just had the two of us for that cruise. And we spent a lot of time on that cruise talking about our upcoming transition. We already knew at that point that I had planned to start businesses, Fit Scientific and GoX Labs, with my business partner. But that 2 weeks gave us really focused time for the two of us to talk about what we thought the biggest changes were going to be, how we were going to deal with it. And it really helped us both kind of set the mental stage for the transition. And it was so important because that made it a little bit easier. When we got into our new neighborhood and it was nothing like being in the military, we found that, you know, we had to work harder to try to get people to open up and say hi and be friendly. And that was our first neighborhood. But our second neighborhood, we found, decided where we wanted to buy a house and bought it. We found they were much more open to that. And I would say that that kind of gets to the biggest challenge, which is finding a way to kind of deal with that initial loss of that sense of community. And how do you feel that? Because it becomes such an important part of who you are. Because in my case, I'd spent 25 years doing it. In her case, she had spent almost 40 years, including the time she was with her family. And so figuring out how you're going to kind of fill that sense of community or replace that sense of community, I think, was probably for me the biggest challenge. I felt like I had this set of skills that I needed and the drive and the business partner. So that was less of a challenge.
Wow, that is awesome. Bruce, I have to tell you, this is the 51st podcast that we've done. And I typically always ask that of the veterans or even military spouses that are being interviewed about their transition and their biggest challenge. You're the first person that's really put it in that perspective. Everybody always talks about how their transition went and maybe a little bit about how it affected their families, but you really put it in the context that people need to hear. It is an entire family transition. It's not just the service member that is going into a brand new world. It's their spouse. It's their kids. It's their entire family that is changing their environment and changing what they've been used to. And especially for somebody that, you know, you've served, you know, more than 20 years, that's a long time to have that sense of community and that structure and that, you know, really security of the military families. So thank you for that. That's really, it is a great perspective. And I love the idea of really sitting down and talking to your spouse about what, you know, what these changes are going to look like, how you're going to manage them, how each of you are feeling about it. Because if you don't, and you just kind of let it fester in there, then things happen. And that's the unfortunate side of the story there for a lot of military veterans and their families. So thank you for that. Well,
sure.
Awesome. So I am so curious about wearable robotics. So talk to us about that. How'd you get into that field? And talk to us more about Fit Scientific's mission and why you're different.
So wearable robotics was really something of an outgrowth from research that my business partner, Joe Hitt, was doing at DARPA. I retired out of West Point as a research center director and associate professor there. Joe had taught with me on two different tours at West Point. Toward the end of his second tour, he was selected to become a DARPA program manager, which is really one of the most difficult jobs to get into in the Department of Defense, especially if you're an officer, because They are so technically far ahead of really where everybody else is. The mission is so high tech and it's so demanding, and it's built in a way to weed out people who just don't have the energy, drive, creativity, and technical sense to do it. In fact, it's interesting, and I wanted to share this about it as well, is in order to do that, you literally have to propose, just as you would like a business proposal with white papers, you know, how you would go about crafting programs for them. And you go through multiple levels until you get, if you're lucky, all the way up to the director of DARPA in order to get selected. Because at the end of the day, once you've been selected, you control programs with hundreds of millions, and in some cases, billions of dollars. And you are really in charge of all of that. And so they want to make sure that they're getting the right folks there. So Joe's programs included very advanced robotics. So I don't know if you've ever seen, for example, the, we kind of refer to it as the headless mule. It's a robot that will follow along behind a soldier. And you can load it up with a bunch of stuff. It was Boston Dynamics made it.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's lots of videos out there on the internet about it. It's really come a long way since back when Joe was working on the program. But anyway, so that was one of his programs. And one of the programs that he started up was this wearable robotics program. And he was one of the very first to get funding in the Department of Defense to start exploring wearable robotics. Now, what does that mean? There were companies already doing exoskeleton type work, very rigid exoskeletons, required a lot of power, and there are separate challenges with that. His approach was, let's go with less heavy, less rigid systems and try to go into more soft systems where you've got a mix of sensors and actuation, but it doesn't require as much power, and it will probably be more transparent to the wearer, which is really important if you're trying to put these systems on soldiers, because everybody's got a great idea for something that could help a soldier in the field. And every good idea costs money and you pay a weight penalty. So the soldier isn't necessarily concerned about how much money it costs at the beginning, but he or she is definitely worried about how much extra weight is this going to add when you strap this thing onto me. So that was a really important part of what he did there. And in part of what my research center did was he would periodically request faculty and cadets who were available looking for research projects to assist by doing independent testing for the government on some of his program components. So that would give him a sense of, you know, what was really going on with his programs. You know, is contractor meeting milestones? Is the performance really what they say it is? And so that was kind of how we first got into that. And he, my PhD had been in design optimization for mechanical systems. His PhD was in biomechanical systems, specifically robotic prosthetics. So it was kind of a mesh of all of those things that we brought together. That's why we decided to get out, didn't decide to get out at that point. When we retired, we decided that would be an interesting thing to pursue, because the exoskeleton business and industry was still a very nascent field, and there were a lot of opportunities, we thought, there. So that's how we got into the field. We started up Fit Scientific first because we recognized that there were lower barriers to entry into industry by getting a service company started. And in our initial plan, before we retired, we had written down a bunch of ideas, put together a white paper, and sent them to people that we knew had the white paper, to people we knew had already gotten out. They'd successfully transitioned. They were working in various places and were in industry somewhere. And we asked them, hey, give us feedback. Here's what we're thinking. Start up a service company. And we think we can, you know, over time, a little bit faster, start to generate some revenue through just services. And then we can start up a little later, in our case, 1 year later, a product company. And their barriers to entry for getting a successful product out into the market are a lot higher. It's a lot harder and it takes a lot longer to do. So we thought, all right, we at least need to generate some revenue. We can have a separate product company and we'll kind of go down that path. So we started consulting for some very high-tech programs, but it was just us. And it's kind of limited because when you get into a consulting job, you may only get 10 hours or you might get 100 hours, but you're certainly not necessarily stringing together, unless you get a long-term contract, you know, say a year's worth of hours on it. So that was fine for a couple of short little job opportunities, but we didn't feel like we would be able to quickly scale that. And it was about at that point in time that I had begun expanding our network with other businesses, other veteran-owned businesses. And one of them, we actually had a couple that said, hey, we'll give you some mentorship. And that was really helpful and was nice, both veteran-owned companies, and learned a lot about federal contracting, which I thought I knew a ton about. But I knew about federal contracting because part of my former job had been as an acquisition officer. So I had done it from the government side. It's completely different when you're on the industry side. You know, everything you thought you knew, yeah, some of that helps, but it is just a whole different ballgame when you're on the industry side. So had a lot to learn about that and had to learn about, you know, writing the proposals could be technically acceptable or maybe even get outstanding reviews. Had to learn about how to price everything from the cost of a person to do work to the cost of a thing, whatever that is, you know, to do work and be on a contract. And so there was a lot of learning that went there. And it was really through the mentorship of these other veteran-owned small businesses that had grown. So they were now no longer small, or they were getting ready to size out of being small. And I'm not sure how familiar you are with this on the federal contracting side, but there are certain programs that are set aside for small businesses, and they might be set aside for a woman-owned small business or a veteran-owned small business or different minority-owned small business, things like that. And then at a certain point in time, companies that have been really successful find that they are now potentially getting large enough that they're getting ready to, quote-unquote, size out. And that's a tricky transition for businesses. Some choose not to. Some say, you know what, I'm gonna stay small within my NAICS codes, and we're just gonna manage the workload we do so that we don't exceed the SBA's size standards. Others say, no, we're gonna keep growing and we'll go. So these two companies that we got to know had decided they were just, you know, gonna keep growing. So one of the things that happens with many of those companies then is as they're in the last couple of years before they size out, they tend to try to build a network of trusted small businesses that they can partner with to go after work that would no longer be accessible to them. So they can be a very qualified subcontractor and they can help mentor the small business through that process. And we were very fortunate that we got to know the veteran leadership in each of these companies. And they really liked the work ethic Joe and I had. And the fact that, yes, we could do program management services, we could do training services, but they were like, wow, you guys are, you got this wearable robotics thing going on. That's kind of crazy. That's a little bit out there. And we would like that as a potential capability for some of our teams for things we want to pursue. And so that's kind of how we got started. And one of the companies that said they wanted to mentor us said, you know, we know you've done some small consulting work, but we'd like to teach you kind of what it's like to actually manage a contract and manage employees. So under them, we started with first one employee on a subcontract, and that grew to four, and then it grew to 15 over the course of 18 months. And that allowed us to learn how to manage an employee, how to pay an employee, how to make sure benefits went correctly to the employee. It let us build a payroll system, a timekeeping system, and do all of those things, an accounting system, and do it in a way where through that 18 months, we were still small enough that I could really do a lot of good analysis about, okay, here's what I bid per hour for that person on that contract. Now, how are we doing? You know, am I covering my costs? Am I making a little bit of overhead money? You know, is there any profit on this? Because at the beginning, you don't necessarily have as good of a sense for that. And so that led us to get into really because the one company was in training services and logistics services, it took us down that path. So there was a little bit of a pivot there. And as we were pivoting there, we said, let's take our wearable robotics stuff and now we'll kind of spin it out into the product company and set that up out in Arizona under different ownership. And we know that's going to take a little bit of time to kind of get going. And so Fit really focused on doing the training services and then logistics support stuff. And then we had our product company doing development on algorithms and sensors that could be used to evaluate people who were wearing exoskeletons. Because we thought, okay, that's going to be a little bit easier since we're such a small company than just trying to build our own exoskeleton. So that worked really well. And Fit Scientific ended up growing very quickly because we won a large contract with the Army. And over the course of the next 18 months, we won a lot of the task orders on that contract. And so we expanded. Our employees were then we're now in six states, coast to coast. And that really taught us what it meant to scale quickly. My wife is my HR manager, and I remember her looking at me when I told her 1 week we were going to have to onboard 100 new employees.
Wow.
She looked at me and she was like, we're doing what? But she had that same, okay, you know, she kind of put on her old, you know, military spouse cap and said, all right, you know, we'll do it. We'll get through it.
Absolutely.
Yep. You know, and she totally jumped into that and it worked really well. And so now we're starting to, once again, now that our product company actually has a successful product, still small, but we're getting it out into manufacturing facilities and airlines and warehouses to assess the risk of injury to workers. It's using a set of algorithms we developed in an R&D program we were doing with the Army, where they wanted us to assess soldier performance and look at optimizing soldiers for training mission. So this is kind of a different use, but it's still utilizing most of the same basic ideas. And it was nice that we could spin it out there. And then at the same time, Fit started saying, okay, well, we have this capability now. We've got our product company has, you know, this set of products and capabilities there. And we want to start getting back into a little bit more of the tech mission. And so we're one of the projects we have now is we're actually on a contract to track soldiers at one military installation during their land navigation training. So we've got mobile cell towers, we've got field operation sites, and we've got, you know, GPS monitoring receivers and communications equipment on these soldiers. And so we can help the military leadership there just keep track of all their folks while they're running out on this course, whether it's during the daytime or especially at night, just right, to make sure that nobody, you know, wanders off the range literally, sure, or if somebody trips over a log and hits their head on something, mm-hmm, you know, and can't speak, that there's a way to kind of locate that person if they're not responding. So that's what we've done now. I would say, you know, there are a lot of companies out there doing the training services mission. Now we're actually starting to really work to differentiate Fit Scientific's capabilities by saying, hey, we've got this other higher tech capability that we can bring to that training service mission, if, you know, if you want us to. And that's kind of on a front end capability side. But one of our biggest differentiators is that there would probably be two. And we've worked on a lot of contracts that are training. A lot of the training service contracts tend to be lowest price technically acceptable, meaning it's, okay, you've put together a proposal, manning, staffing, and support that is acceptable to the government. And say there were three or four proposals that were acceptable to the government. Now the government is going to select the one that was the lowest cost. So it's, mm-hmm, always a balance between how do we provide the capability that's necessary, but, you know, have a shot at winning because it's a low priced contract.
Right.
So what we've done is we've always worked hard, even when it is one of those types of contract where the margins are really tight. I tell my folks and my program management team, they're all veterans themselves. They take the same approach too. It's like, look, Yes, it was a lowest price contract, but this is still a military customer that we're supporting. And we were all military, and these are soldiers, or they are Coast Guardsmen that we are supporting and training. And so there is nobody on my team that would ever want to shortchange a soldier or a Coast Guardsman or an airman in their training. And so they work really hard with our government clients to still provide excellent service and support while we're executing these contracts. So that's one thing. That's kind of our upfront piece. And the second part is on the backside. My business partner's wife became our benefits manager. She had been a critical care nurse and then was a case manager for a large HMO. And I thought she would be perfect if she was willing to take the job of helping us to run payroll and benefits when it got too much for me to handle. Mm-hmm. So I had my wife as the HR manager and his wife as the benefits and payroll manager. And because they had both been around soldiers for so long, taking care of soldiers, and they had been family support group leaders when we were deployed, so they were used to helping to take care of the families that were kind of left behind. They both kept that same attitude and took it right into the workplace. And when they would interface with our employees, they treated them like people. Mm-hmm. And that may sound funny, but for so many contractors, I have been told they feel like they just bounce from one contract to the next, from one contractor to the next. And they just never feel that sense of belonging and family. And they miss it a lot. And we talked about that at the beginning, that that's one of the hardest things when people transition. And so every employee we've got is treated like the individual they are, and they're treated like a valued member of our team. And that's been really important too, because our people are the biggest value that we have in the company. And without all of those great folks, 90% of whom are either veterans or spouses of veterans, we would not be where we are today.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think there's a quote, the CEO of Salesforce talks about hiring being one of the most important keys to growth, and that it must be the most important job that you do, because hiring the staff that basically run your company, that provide the services, provide the products, you can't do it without them. So that's so awesome. I just love, as I'm sitting here listening to you talk, I'm thinking, can I have a job? I would love to work for you. This is awesome. It's fantastic. And that's the kind of culture that, more companies need to adopt, because by doing that, you create an environment where people want to work hard for you. They want to see you successful, because then they're successful and they feel part of something. And it is a great, great culture that you're building there. Congratulations. That is truly awesome. So you've talked a bit about the success you've achieved and what the journey has been like. Where do you see the future of the company going?
Yeah, so the future is we're going to continue to expand and scale. We really want to start going after larger and larger contracts. I mean, we are still at this point a small business, but on my roadmap and with our strategic planning, we have to prepare ourselves to get bigger, to size out at some point in the next few years if all continues to go as it is now. And so we're looking at other opportunities. We're also looking at more technical training opportunities where we can, again, continue to really marry our expertise in wearable sensing and robotic technology with the training component. And so it's kind of bringing those two ideas back together. So that's a big part of the future for Fit Scientific. And then, looking at going after other types of work and getting into other agencies, because that's important as well to, as many people are seeing now, mm-hmm. with the whole COVID-19 challenge that we face right now, companies that are kind of like singly capable can be very vulnerable depending on what the crisis is. In the case of any crisis, if you don't have some diversity in your portfolio of capabilities, then, it could be weeks before you run into difficulty keeping the business going. And mm-hmm. so that's an important part of we've been doing that, and we've been kind of diversifying our portfolio. We've been going after bigger opportunities, continuing to expand our network of opportunities. And so that's kind of where we want to see the company continue to go. And we're starting to mentor the next generation of small veteran-owned businesses that are coming up, because we have to prepare to do that. And it's also a way for me to pay it forward, you know, with all the mentorship we've got.
I wanted to touch on that too. You mentioned having the mentors and how that really helped you kind of guide you through some of the initiatives that you were going through, or the growth stages and things like that. So that is a good thought for people out there who want to start their own businesses. Find mentors. We've got an outstanding advisory board at Veterans Ascend, and they're just a wealth of expertise and knowledge, and just we're very blessed to have them. So I totally agree with you there. So tell us your best advice for a service member or veteran who wants to start their own business, just their transition, or who's interested in the robotics field.
Sure.
Big question.
No. I was asked to speak up at MIT at the Sloan School of Management on this very topic. There were veterans in the audience, but it wasn't just veterans. It was a class for entrepreneurial graduate engineers. So these were engineers, and again, some of them were veterans, most were not, who were very specifically interested in, they were getting a combined graduate degree in engineering, but they were also getting an MBA, and they all wanted to go out and start their own business. So I was asked to speak to them, and I did. And first thing I said is, okay, so you want to start your own business. What is my advice to you? And I said, don't do it. And they all looked at me and I said, don't do it. And they kind of looked at me blankly, and they looked at their instructor, and I said, okay, I'm going to say it one more time. Don't do it. And, and then I paused and I said, okay, if you've gotten past the three don't do it, then we can talk a little bit more if you're still interested. Now, why would I say don't do it? Let's talk about the challenges. And then I kind of launch into talking about things like, we retired and we took almost all of our money out of the market, and that money started going into getting the businesses up and started. Mm-hmm. I remember at one point, we weren't taking salary. And I remember at one point, my wife looking at me saying, hey, at what point does the business start paying us instead of us paying the business? And it was really about a year, a little over a year, I think, before we started taking any salary, because we were trying to grow the capabilities in the business. And I wanted to make sure that we were paying our handful of employees at the time, and that we had the ability to start growing systems that cost money that we didn't have a whole lot of money for. And so I said, you're going to need to think about, what does your first 2 years look like? And my business partner and I, we sat down before we started the businesses, and we each put together a very detailed spreadsheet that was a net worth analysis, and it had all of our personal liabilities and all of our personal assets. And then we gave those spreadsheets to each other so that we could look at them. You have to have that kind of trust, because so many businesses fall apart because one business partner may have some hidden debts, mm-hmm, or something hanging out there that somebody else doesn't know about. And it's how many businesses fail and fall apart, is because somebody runs away with some or all of the money at some point. And so we didn't want to do that. So that was one thing. And we also were prepared to each go up to 2 years without any salary. And that was why we were taking money out of the market. We were living on savings and doing things like that. Now, it did help for those who have retired. If you get some sort of a pension, you automatically have that as a floor. So that helps a lot. So, you know, you at least have that. It may mean that you're making, you know, 50% of what you were when you retired, but you at least have that.
Right.
So that was one thing, is you've got to be able to trust your partner. And at the beginning, you need to understand the financial circumstances for both. Two, there was a great study that was done, I think it was at Harvard years ago, that just looked at the number of people that were involved in a startup company and the likelihood of success 5 years later. You know, most small businesses fail within the first 3 to 5 years. And what they found is there was a direct correlation between likelihood of being in business and successful 5 years later with the number of people that were part of that effort. So the more people who were part of that effort, the higher the likelihood of success. If it was just one person, it was less likely to be successful. Not to say that it can't be, but it was less likely to be successful.
Right.
Now, what I tell people is the key there is seven people may make a business more likely to be successful. You don't necessarily want seven owners. That creates its own challenges.
Yes.
So when they were talking about the number of people who were getting the startup going and the business off the ground, the article wasn't addressing owners or co-founders. They were simply addressing the fact that if you're the only one pulling on that particular heavy load, it gets tiring really quickly.
Yes.
If you've got other people helping to pull that load or push it, you know, whichever you need to be doing, you are more likely to be able to keep going. And so that just a couple of things to think about. The other thing is when I spoke with this group, and I would say this to everybody too, you need to understand costing and pricing. It's very important. A lot of people who say, well, I'm not very good at math and I don't like spreadsheets and I'll just hire somebody else to do that. If you are going to start up a company and you want it to be successful, first of all, you need to know every aspect of your business. I wore every hat at the beginning. I was the HR manager at one point before we got over four employees. That point brought somebody else on. I did run all the books for the first 2 years because wow. I needed to know how every dollar was spent mm-hmm. and where the potential was for wastage, to the point that when I then turned it over to our bookkeeper that we have now, who is a veteran spouse, by the way, just as an aside, veteran spouse, the wife of my brother, and she was having difficulty. Her son was homeschooled and she spent many years at home with him. She has a degree in accounting and worked in industry for a very long time. She needed some flexibility to start getting back into the workplace and wanted to start building her resume again, but it's very difficult to do in her circumstances. She needed uh-huh. the flexibility because she was still homeschooling. She needed some way to show that she had still been working.
Right.
You know, before getting in with a big business or something. So we were able to offer her flexibility. Yep, you can work mostly from home and you can, you know, if you need to take time to go take care of your son, my nephew, that's fine, you know. And it's she happens to be my sister-in-law, but we treat all of our corporate employees the same way too. Now that she's got the books, I know when I need to ask a question. And I know as I'm reviewing the books now, kind of more from a CFO role, I know exactly when something doesn't look quite right. Mm-hmm. And so I can ask those right questions. And so that's really important too, is you got to dig into that as well. The last thing I will say is that's all kind of the technical part of starting up a business. The very first thing you have to be able to ask and answer is what makes my business different? What will be the set of differentiators that I have to offer? Because you're going to have to, in order to be successful, you're going to have to talk to that and you're going to have to be able to demonstrate that. So that's kind of it on the business side. And on the robotics side, robotics is a really tough field to get into. Probably the toughest thing to just kind of start up your own business. So for that, what you might even consider doing is going to work for a small company initially that's working in that field and see what it's like to be in a product company, especially if it's doing some sort of robotics, and get a sense of that, because that's very different from the service business. It's easier for people from the military to transition into some sort of a training or service support business versus a product startup. So you can learn some things from some other companies that are out there for the first couple of years. And then if you still think that that's something that you want to go into, then you'll at least have a better sense of what that could look like when you start to carve your own path.
Yeah, that's great advice on any field, really, not just robotics too, that you know they're interested in, right? So get some of that background knowledge. Well, I must say, I love the show The Prophet. Marcus Lemonis would be very proud of you because you know your numbers, you know what all those numbers mean. So good job for you. And it's great advice. It really truly is that if you don't know how your company is spending money or where the money is going, you're doomed to lose it very quickly. So congratulations. Well, Bruce, thank you so much. Just congratulations for your continued success. And we look forward to hearing more about Fit Scientific and all the great things that you're doing. Congratulations again on being number one on the Vet 100 list. That's veteran-owned companies. That's quite an accomplishment. Got a lot of good, companies out there. So we appreciate you sharing these great insights today and wish you again much continued success. So listeners, for more information on Fit Scientific, please visit their website at www.fitt-sci.net. fitt-sci.net. And for more information on Veterans Ascend, please visit our website at veteransascend.com. Thank you, everyone. Stay safe. Have a great day.